You're listening to Scopes Monkey Choir. Music in a rational universe.
Scopes Monkey Choir.
Music in a rational universe.
I'm Matt.
And I'm Haiting.
This is episode 3-1.
3+1? Episode 4?
Yes, episode 4. So, a couple of news items quick before we get to the meat of the matter. I just wanted to mention the study that was... here's the title is Reaction to Sound May Help Separate Conscious Patients from Vegetative Patients. It's an interesting study. It's preliminary, which we all know what that means.
And of course, we're talking about conscious but paralyzed.
Because
there are other ways to separate conscious patients from vegetative ones.
That's a good point. It didn't even occur to me. Go figure.
Not paralyzed, but immobile.
Right.
Comatose?
So they took 21 people with severe brain injuries. They had a healthy control group of 22. And they played them over, I think it was a series of days, they played a series of sounds with unexpected changes of tone. So sort of regular things, but then it does something very unexpected. And they had everyone hooked up to EEGs. And they found that the patients that were in already diagnosed vegetative states, they did have a spike on the EEG when the unexpected change in sound happened, but they had a much shorter period spike than the minimally conscious people. Now, their interpretation of this, and this is based on some stuff that's beyond me, so also this is preliminary, and there's a, but they're speculating, is that the sound signal is going into the brain of the vegetative state, and the signals are being registered as sound and are being sent to the frontal cortex, which is where, you know, the higher functions happen. But then nothing is being sent back from the frontal cortex. So they said in the minimally conscious people and also in the controls, a signal comes in, it's a sound, it gets sent to the frontal cortex, so the frontal cortex can say, I am a human being, let me figure out what this is and what it means. And now I will figure it out, and now I will send it back to everyone else.
No, that's what's happening in the actually fully conscious control group. In the comatose but conscious patients, probably all that's happening is that the frontal cortex is going, oh, that was a sound.
Well, except they're speculating that the people in the minimally conscious state are sending something back. The frontal cortex is sending something.
That's what
back.
I meant. It's right, sending. Yeah. It's not sending as much back as the brain of a healthy moving around.
Right,
person.
But noticeably more than the people in the vegetative state.
Did you notice how it compares?
I read it, but I didn't take notes on it.
Right, this one's complicated. I guess we have to leave this to the experts, but it's very interesting.
It's preliminary, and so we'll have to see how it pans out. But it did remind me just quickly of, there was a study in February of this year, of 2011, that used music and voice stimulus on patients with disorders of consciousness. So that's like coma, vegetative state, and they included some highly sedated patients too, which is interesting.
Disorders of consciousness.
Yeah.
What a strange way of putting
it. So they were checking vital signs and facial expressions. And what they did is they had relatives of the patients record a voice message. And then they also had the relatives choose one of the patient's favorite songs. And then they did these comparisons where they played the voice messages and they played the songs and they got some data on that.
Huh.
And the conclusion was that the voice message had a stronger stimulus, was a stronger stimulus than the music.
Oh, wow.
Which is interesting. So that also is preliminary. But it's interesting. People seem to be really looking in this direction. And it'll be interesting to see what they find.
We're going to have to start calling the comatose the consciousness challenged.
Exactly.
All right, that's enough of that. I have perhaps a new segment here.
Well said.
I'm going to read some listener feedback. That's all I'm trying to say.
And yeah, we've been getting more feedback, and it's so awesome. Thank you all.
Yeah, so I'm going to read a bit. This is in response to episode number 28, Metronome versus Tuning Fork.
Fork.
And this is from Adrienne. I apologize for mispronunciation of names. So her comment is as follows. It's in response to your mention of that study where they had people listen to a metronome set at different speeds and just draw circles.
Oh, right, right.
And they, at the slower speeds, they drew bigger circles. And we kind of laughed this off and said, well, that's interesting, but totally useless. So Adrian writes this in response. I think the metronome drawing circles study isn't entirely useless. As a wannabe conductor musicologist, I am always scrutinizing a conductor's gesture to find out its expressive purpose and how the execution invokes the response that it does, particularly choral conductors. You know how sensitive those singer types are. Of course, a choir's response to gesture is going to depend heavily on the teaching that surrounds it, but there certainly seem to be some fundamentally intuitive gestures/responses. The example that the study brought to mind was the relationship between the size of a conductor's gesture and the ensemble's interpretation of his intended tempo. Generally speaking, though most choral ensembles are not aware of this quote-unquote rule, they still interpret a larger gesture as a slower tempo, which is why conductors flailing their arms, desperate to get their lagging choir to go faster for Christ's sake, get nowhere. We've all seen it. And a smaller gesture as a faster one. Right, that was after a closed parenthesis. I've seen it in rehearsals from elementary school to college to professional choirs. This study looked at the relationship from the other side of it. I would say that though the study seems a bit simplistic and obscure in application, it seems to add plausibility to the idea of an intuitive, innate relationship between shape size, sure, it's a word, and tempo.
Mm-hmm.
And thank you, Adrian. I too have seen this many a time, and many people who have sung with choirs at all levels have seen how bigger, faster circles do not manage to make a choir speed up, and the best conductors will make very small gestures in order to make the tempo go faster, even though when you say it like that, it's a little counterintuitive.
Mm-hmm.
So thank you, Adrian.
We're going to have to look into that more when we get around to doing our conducting episode.
Yeah.
Which is going to be really hard to do without any visuals.
I'm not sure.
Flailing our arms around.
That might have to be a Scopes Monkey Choir YouTube video.
Oh, yeah. We're going to get into that.
All right. Now, on to the meat of this podcast.
Oh, my God.
Today.
That's right.
Provided you are listening on April 29th, 2011. This piece was premiered in Paris at the Théâtre des Champs-Élysées with choreography by Nijinsky.
And we mentioned this just a couple of episodes ago, and we thought we'd follow up on it and talk about the famous or infamous premiere of The Rite of Spring story.
Which is what you're listening to.
Yes. By Stravinsky. And we thought, oh, well, we talked about it. We should follow up on it. We should talk about the premiere of the famous story. And totally coincidentally, we started researching and everything, and totally coincidentally, halfway through the research, we were like, oh, it's the 98th anniversary on the day that we're releasing this podcast. How convenient. What a nice coincidence, shall we say.
Indeed. The common story, the myth surrounding this premiere, is that there was a huge riot because of Stravinsky's music.
Yes, because it was so radical and changed everything, and people got violent and they started rioting, and it went out into the streets and
it went on for 3 days.
Yeah, and you've probably all heard versions of this story. It's all over the... I mean, you just... Rite of Spring premiere, Google. There are just thousands of newspaper articles, blog entries, et cetera, you name it. And that's the story. So we thought, let's look into it. Let's find out as best we can what really did happen.
And why, perhaps.
And why. So, let us begin. How are we going to start? What are we on? Okay. First, am I allowed to start with complaining about Radiolab?
I don't know if we should mention them by name and complain about Radiolab.
Oh, okay. Can I complain about an unnamed radio show?
Sure, if you don't name it.
There was this unnamed radio show in, I think it was 2007, that talked about the Rite of Spring premiere. And I'm not going to get into details, but because they put in this whole context where they're trying to explain how the brain deals with new information, and then they claim
new sound,
and then they claim that it applies to the entire city of Paris or something like that,
and could cause a riot.
Yeah, and I mean their description of the riot is just as graphic as everyone else's, and
maybe even more because they're the ones who said it went out into the street and lasted 3 days.
Yeah, this is actually a quote: caused a few nights of violent riots. So. You see, you know, what's going on here. But I've been told that I complain too much about this unnamed radio show.
So which we love, by the way.
It's just so not skeptical. Anyway.
Yes, but they're very interesting and well done.
Oh, wait. Hold on. Wait, this is the good part coming up. Oh, yeah. Yeah, it's the famous part. Sorry to shush you.
You don't shush me. I'm hopping up and down over here. Knock-kneed, of course.
Yeah.
Which is what the dance looked like.
So, those of you out there who don't know jack shit about classical music, you may recognize this from Fantasia, Disney's Fantasia. It was one of the segments, though they did change quite a bit and annoyed Stravinsky. So... We started with the obvious thing, by going back and trying to find as many original sources as we could get our hands on. So, for instance, the New York Times wrote an article on the premiere in 1913, just a couple of days after the premiere happened.
A
week after, okay. Mm-hmm. The subtitle was... Oh, no, the title was Parisians Hiss New Ballet. I also thought it was sort of interesting that they called it The Consecration of Spring. The standard
nice.
Translation hadn't yet happened yet. So can I read a clip? So here's a clip, not a clip, quote, a dugong. Anyway, so here's from the New York Times article about it. The piece was received with a storm of hissing. The manager, M. Astruc, however, has devised a novel method for silencing a demonstration. When hisses are mingled with counter cheers, as they were the other night, M. Estruc orders the lights turned up.
That's Monsieur Estruc, by the way, that M stands for.
Yeah, I'm just avoiding saying that. I avoid French whenever possible. So he orders the lights turned up. Instantly, the booing and hissing stop. Well-known people who are hostile to the ballet do not desire to appear in an undignified role. So, that's a 1 week after the premiere description of the premiere.
Sounds to me kind of like maybe riotous behavior was par for the course in Paris, which is what I would have guessed considering the Parisians of today and their behavior in public, and then also the fact that the theaters of Paris at the time were basically a social gathering, and like everywhere in Europe, people gathered and talked and yelled and shouted at each other and threw things that maybe...
Yeah, I mean, in that quote...
We would have thought it was a riot if we were there, but that was just what happened every night.
And in that quote, you hear that the manager actually had in place a method of quieting the audience when they got rowdy. So clearly it happened. So, but nevertheless, that's one Times article, you know, and they didn't have the interwebs back then. Who knows how, you know, information got about. Now, there was another... Oh, you looked in... You saw that article in Le Figaro, right?
Oh, yes. I actually went and read all of the Figaros from the week. Le Figaro. I read every single one from the week after the Rite of Spring, and it was quite a chore, I must tell you. I mean that I read them in French. In PDFs online. Not to brag, but boy, did I have a headache after that. I did not find any. I did not find that article that the Times purports to be quoting, but.
Oh yeah, because they. Yeah, they.
Oh, we're not exactly sure why, but it may have been the wrong date, or I may actually have overlooked it. Who knows? Or they may have made the whole thing up.
But
or it might have been a foreign correspondent.
But they had an actual review of the the piece, right?
They had an actual review by their usual theater, dance, music reviewer.
Uh huh. And what do you say?
Well, he basically said that he said a couple of things. First of all, he said that it was all Nijinsky's fault.
Right.
Basically, he blamed it on Nijinsky. He said, quote, after being mocked once by the public, to repeat a joke with such heavy insistence seems in pretty poor taste. That's what he was saying about Nijinsky's choreography, because Paris had seen another ballet by Nijinsky and they had not really liked it. He then goes on to say that it's really too bad that Stravinsky, a musician of the caliber of Stravinsky, was drawn into a ridiculous joke like this.
Right. And also, two weeks earlier, there was another Nijinsky choreographed piece that had totally bombed. And so Paris was mad at Nijinsky.
Oh,
and then
yeah. Not only was Paris mad at Nijinsky for that choreography 2 weeks before, but he had made a huge scandal the year before with his dancing, where he
the Afternoon of the Faun, right?
Yes.
What did he do?
Well, the choreography, which was his, and he also was the lead dancer. The choreography to Debussy's Afternoon of a Faun involved basically simulating masturbation into a scarf that belonged to a nymph that the faun had stolen, and that's how he spends his afternoon, basically.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So that had caused a great scandal. But I want to go on and say a little more about what this this reviewer Henri Kittard, which may be a pen name, said about the music for this great scandalous piece of revolutionary art. So what he says is, can Monsieur Stravinsky imagine that a melody will achieve a decisive intensity and eloquence just because it is doubled a step up or a step down for 50 measures? We must think so, because that's how it goes. And the novelties within the score of The Rite of Spring are mostly of this sort. And since no one has the right to question the sincerity of an artist, above all when he has apparently proven it already, what's left to do? Give up understanding and deplore such a strange aberration. I know well that in taking this attitude, I am exposing myself to seeming like a reactionary soul, closed to any attempts at novelty. It is a risk one must take. Certainly, the history of music abounds with anecdotes bursting with the incomprehension of critics who knew not how to recognize the creative genius upon its first appearance.
Mm.
Will the future arrange a triumphant revenge for new music as Monsieur Stravinsky seems to understand it? Only time will tell.
Time has told.
So basically he's foreseeing his own, the critic is foreseeing his own downfall.
Yeah.
However, he goes on to say, to tell the truth, I doubt that my defeat is so near. As complex as the music to The Rite of Spring appears, as far from the traditional forms and conventions as it seems to force itself, it is simple to disentangle the grander lines if you strip them of the barbarous clamor and the noisy dissonances with which it pleased the composer to pair them. After this work of analysis, the music doesn't contain any prodigious innovation from which a rejuvenation of art might one day reasonably arise. Its proceedings are quite regular, much more so than would be fitting for a revolutionary. So basically, he's saying it was boring.
Ho hum.
He was saying not that exciting, Stravinsky.
Yeah, yeah. So I think y'all can see where we're going here. Everything that we found, whatever hissing, whatever booing happened, and we don't see any reason to think that there was that much more than sometimes happens.
Several of the reviews do say that at some point the audience gave up on listening because they were more interested in yelling about the choreography.
Yeah, everyone seems to agree that that it got noisy enough that basically you couldn't really hear the music.
Yeah, there I have an anecdote from from an assistant choreographer, an English woman who was there helping Nijinsky. Mm-hmm. She said that someone shouted as when the dancers started doing their hopping thing. Someone shouted, "Someone get a doctor! No, a dentist! Two dentists!" Because apparently as a comment that it looked like the dancers needed medical aid.
I have another nice quote here from an article about Stravinsky from 1916, which it was just called Impressions of Igor Stravinsky, and I found it interesting because in 1916, and when he talks about the Rite of Spring, it's like this little piece, this little sort of mistake that Stravinsky made. You know, Stravinsky had a couple of major pieces that had taken everyone by storm. And then in 1916, he talks about it like, oh, the Rite of Spring was this little mistake kind of thing and people didn't like it. But once again in that, he describes the trouble as coming from the dance. And my favorite quote was, he says that it was described, that he heard it described as Swedish gymnastics. I don't know what that means, but I don't think it's good. But
there's a recreation.
Swedes do gymnastics.
There's an attempt at recreating Nijinsky's choreography by the Joffrey Ballet in the 80s, which you can all search for on YouTube, and you can see how...
We'll link to it. I already have the link up.
Yeah, you can see how very unclassical it was. A warning, that recreation is done on very few notes that were left, because actually, Diaghilev, the impresario of the Ballet Russe, which was the company that had hired Nijinsky to do this, and of which Nijinsky was a principal dancer. Diaghilev basically suppressed and kind of buried the original choreography.
Oh,
and
really?
He, in fact, had it re-choreographed in 1920 by, I think,
was a Brit,
Leonid
wasn't it?
Massine.
Oh. Uh-huh.
I think the name is Massine. And basically threw away... burned, suppressed all of Nijinsky's efforts, and Stravinsky encouraged him in this. He was really eager to distance himself from Nijinsky's ideas.
Yeah, and as has been pointed out too, less than a year after the premiere, the Rite of Spring was done just in a concert version, so without any dance in Paris, and everyone loved it. And for me, like, a lot of people tell that story to show like, oh, look how quickly the public, you know, changes their tastes or figured out that they had a genius in their midst or something like that. And I think it's just that when the dance wasn't there, they could hear the music and they heard that the music is awesome.
Well, also, there were supporters of the music at the time in the theater. And several of these accounts talk about how part of the problem in the theater was that some people wanted to love it and some people wanted to hate it, and
right,
people were
yeah.
shouting at each other about it. And in fact, that same Henri Quittard of the Figaro mentions how at the end some supporters kind of stormed the stage and gave Nijinsky and Stravinsky an ovation, and that the rest of the audience was embarrassed by this and thought it was...
Oh, wait, where is that from? I didn't see that.
Comical. That's from the review in the Figaro that I read.
So it's just...
But speaking of this thing about new music and the shocking sound of this music, I kind of wanted to try to give a little bit of context about what was happening in 1913 in music. This music was not necessarily revolutionary in terms of what was going on in Europe. So if we could...
It's certainly not as weird as some of the stuff that was going on.
No, so let's hear, for instance, another scandalous piece that was given in Dresden, premiered in Dresden in 1909 and in London in 1911, which is Richard Strauss's Elektra. Here's a piece of it.
Well, I'll just fade that down here.
Now, admittedly, it wasn't performed in Paris before the Rite of Spring, and in fact, I'm not sure exactly when it was performed in Paris. It may not have been actually until the middle of the century. But nonetheless, that had been heard in Europe more than once before the Rite of Spring. And here's another a huge revolutionary piece of 20th century music by Arnold Schoenberg. This is a bit of Piero Lunaire. Mm-hmm. So not as raucous, partially because it's a piece of chamber music.
The voice seems a bit familiar.
Yes, this is me with the Proteus Ensemble. This was one of the first big pieces of atonal music, and not only that, it was for an actress. It was not to be sung, but to be sung spoken. It's called Arnold Schoenberg called it Sprechstimme, and it was basically kind of like this weird sing song thing where he gave notes to each word, but they were definitely not to be sung. He insisted that they were in somewhere between sung and spoken. And this was received at its premiere with a standing ovation, and I think they had to repeat some parts of it. It was a huge success in Vienna. Now, admittedly, this is Vienna, where a lot of actually revolutionary stuff was going on in music between Schoenberg and Berg and Webern, the second Viennese school, who kind of created the 20th century atonality.
Mm-hmm.
And this was not a huge thing in Paris, but Vienna was not that far away, and I'm sure some of the audience in Paris had heard this stuff. But they probably did have a little more a little gentler tastes in Paris.
Maybe.
I'd love to just play for a moment a bit of The Afternoon of a Faun, which was the scandalous ballet that Nijinsky masturbated.
The masturbation ballet.
That's
masturbation
right.
Ballet.
The way a faun spends his afternoon. So this is what the music sounded like to that. In some ways, it sounds to me like a kind of kinder, gentler Rite of Spring.
I guess it just sounds...
You know, it starts with a solo instrument playing a kind of folk melody, and then it gets a little thicker, and it's a little bit like primitivist, which was a huge movement in this part of the world at this time. A celebration of things folky,
like masturbation.
And human sacrifice.
Yeah, it's like the two pillars of civilization.
We slogged through a lot of musicology papers in looking for stuff about this, and there were a lot of analyses of movement in art at this point and how...
I almost poked my eyes out.
No, but I thought there was this interesting thing about how some people thought one of the problems with the ballet, the Rite of Spring, was that it kind of pointed out how the human experience was not spiritual, that it was, they had this word at the time, biologique, that it was just biological.
Damn straight.
And that this the choreography to this ballet really kind of like laid that open and said, this is what we're based on. And some ballet historians thought that that was what was so scandalous about this. But that's sort of like one of those, one of those way over-interpreted historical. Yeah. But that, and then again, it's French art. So they are much given to over-interpretation.
Right.
And big words.
So where did the sort of over-hyped version of the story of the Rite of Spring premiere come from?
Oh, I would say most definitely from Stravinsky himself.
I see, that was a rhetorical question.
You know more about it than I do.
No, I don't. But a little thing happened after the Rite of Spring premiere, this little thing called The Great War, and a lot of things were on hold. What with all the killing? The Rite of Spring wasn't published until 1921. And the first references to...
Wait, are you saying that the Rite of Spring caused the First World War?
That's what I'm saying.
That's absolutely outrageous.
No, I have proof. I have evidence. I have proof and evidence. No, it's just that when it was published and then started having more and more concert performances, Mr. Stravinsky himself, like as you mentioned before, he tried to distance himself from the dance, from it sort of being a ballet piece, and he wanted it to be just a piece of music on its own.
But he loved the idea of the succès du scandale.
Yeah, and so he himself started hyping up what the premiere had been about. He himself started taking, shall we say, credit for the trouble that it caused. And as far as I can tell, it just sort of started tumbling from there, and yarns started being spun, and eventually ridiculous things are said. Like I heard a story once that at the premiere of The Rite of Spring, there was a man beating time on the head of the bald man in front of him.
Now, wait a second. And that actually came from somebody who said he was in the orchestra.
But the point is that's not true.
Because it might have been.
If you're a bald man and someone starts pounding on the back of your head, like, you move or yell or do something after the first pound. You don't... Do you see what I mean?
Pure anecdote. Pure.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying.
Pure mythology.
That's like one of a million kinds of things you hear about what happened. You hear about people like, you know, sword fighting with canes and, you know...
Old ladies hitting each other with umbrellas.
Yeah, and all sorts of things. And it's just...
It might have all happened. But it might have just been the way the Parisians behaved.
It didn't all happen.
It might have just been the way the Parisians behaved at the theater. That's the thing. In fact, that article from the Times has the author is kind of warning the Parisian audiences that they're really rude and they should stop treating visiting artists from Russia with such rudeness.
Right.
Because it's not what they deserve.
Yeah.
Also, I must add this funny detail in, or this extremely boring detail in here, that that Monsieur Astruc, the manager of the theater, had only opened the theater where this was performed. He had opened it 2 months before this premiere, and he had an enormous revenue ticket sales. He was selling, I don't know. It falls in the no, but it was actually commented upon on the front page of the Figaro that he was complaining about how difficult it was to run his theater, but then someone checked his receipts and he had some 600,000 francs in profit.
Ooh la la.
I don't know what that even means in money of the time, but it was impressive enough to be on the front page of the Figaro.
Yeah. Yeah.
During that week. So he was raking it in.
Yeah.
On all his scandals.
Yeah.
And turning up the lights to try to keep his theater goers from rioting.
Yeah. So I guess we can't technically give a conclusion, but I think, you know, it was the dance, not the music. And what it was not that big a deal. That's my conclusion. But I mean, you know.
That's how it seems to me, I have to say.
Yeah. Yeah.
And Stravinsky really played up the myth, and he has won.
He was a myth maker
at this point.
And he has won. That is, the story is really, accepted wisdom.
Yeah, and you can't really begrudge him that. he has won, and boy, that critic has lost.
Well, that's fine.
That critic foresaw his own downfall.
So we should maybe end this segment with the little factoid that 5 days after the Rite of Spring, Stravinsky got sick, and it actually...
from eating oysters.
Ended up being typhoid fever.
What?
And he was in the hospital for 5 weeks.
Okay, there was another myth. He put out that it was from eating oysters.
Oh, that I don't know. I read it in the Grove Dictionary of Music.
Oh, very interesting. Because the source that I saw said that he had eaten celebratory oysters and gotten sick from those. And
well, you could, right? I mean, typhoid fever is you get it when you're exposed to human excrement, right? So you can get it from any food that gets prepared by someone who didn't wash their hands. Anyway.
It all meant also that he never saw a second performance of Nijinsky's choreography.
Mm.
He saw only one.
Yeah.
Premiere. Then he got sick, and he never saw another one.
And then the war, and then God, I'd want to make up a story too.
It was all caused by the Rite of Spring.
Those are the Northumbrian small pipes, and they are the instrument du jour of the week. The Northumbrian small pipes.
It sounds a little dirty.
What? Instrument du jour of the week or Northumbrian small pipes?
Yeah.
They call me more Northumbrian giant pipe. Is that what you mean? That's underneath. You're hearing Colin Ross playing the Northumbrian small pipes. And I just want to say a couple things. It's a kind of bagpipe. It's bellows driven, so you don't blow into them. You actually have a little tiny bellows under one arm, and you have the pipes sort of holding with your other arm, and then you have the drones, and you're playing.
So you don't have to blow at all.
Right, exactly. So you can sing along with them because they're also not that loud.
Oh. Nice.
They come in various different kinds. Oh, by the way, Northumberland is the northernmost county of England, which is where they originate from.
So they're English, not Irish or Scottish pipes.
Right. They have counterparts. There's a Scottish counterpart. But these ones are distinct in a couple of ways. They typically have four drones, sometimes three. There are a lot of different variations, and a seven-keyed chanter.
Keys.
Yeah, they actually have little keys, like metallic buttons like you can clarinet. Push. So that allows them to get a much wider range. They tend to have almost 2-octave range.
Oh, cool.
As opposed to the Scottish Highland bagpipes, which have only 9 notes.
Where you just cover holes with your fingers.
Right. And one of the other differences is that the chanter for the Northumberland small pipes is closed at the end. So when you put down all your fingers, the chanter doesn't make any sound. So if you hear... If you listen, there's actually places where there's a little break between notes. You can actually stop the sound.
Oh, because the air comes out the drones still.
Right. And I assume you have to sort of adjust the bellows when you do that, because you want to keep the drones as steady as possible. And there's also that has a parallel bore in the chanter, and some of you maybe remember us talking about acoustics earlier. Parallel bore just means that it's not a round bore, it's parallel bore, which is what makes it a little more...
What? No, a round
bore. Not a
triangular, not a conical bore.
Not conical, that's right.
So the size of the hole in the middle of the chanter is the same
is
at the top
same,
and
right.
the bottom.
And that makes it a little slightly mellower tone. Oh, I guess one other thing that's sort of interesting in terms of these folk instruments is that the Northumbrian Pipers Society has 750 members worldwide.
Wow. That's not
but
very
many. But there are only about 100 outside of the UK,
okay.
And of their members, about half live within 50 miles of where the instrument came from.
Wow.
So it's really still pretty much a local instrument.
That's amazing.
And they're beautiful. I love them.
It is. You should become a member of the Northumbrian Pipe Society. The 751st.
I don't play them. I would like to. I don't. You want to play a little bit of next week's instrument du jour of the week?
Sure. Here's next week's instrument du jour of the week.
There you go. So we're all done, and thank you for listening to Scopes Monkey Choir from scopesmonkeychoir.com.
We are professional musicians, but we are not scientists.
If you doubt something we've said, don't believe us. Look it up yourself.
Nevertheless, each episode page at scopesmonkeychoir.com has references and citations.
We welcome your feedback. Write to scopesmonkeychoir@gmail.com.
Or leave a message on the monkey phone.
347-788-0330.
You can follow us on Twitter. I am ScopesMonkey. Someday I'll figure out how Twitter works, but I am at ScopesMonkeys.
I am at Squidocto. See you next week.
See you next week. Bye.